Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Books with Bert, a podcast by Young America's Foundation, the nation's leading conservative youth organization. Thank you for joining me as we go through my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. In history class, you may have heard of Cornelius Vanderbilt. The U.S. steamship industry was what he helped begin. You may also have heard of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Gibbons versus Ogden. The two events here are connected and are part of a great story that helped shape U.S. history. Steamships were invented in the early 1800s, and they were one of the greatest inventions in world history. Why? Because steamships transformed business and travel. They could move people and merchandise very quickly on water upstream from one city to another. Moving upstream is important here. Any ship can sail downstream on a river, but steam power allowed steamships to move rapidly upstream as well. Robert Fulton, an American, built the first effective steamboat in the world. As a reward, the state of New York gave Fulton a 30-year monopoly. Only Fulton, or someone he approved of, could legally operate a steamboat for profit in the state of New York. Fulton set the rates for travel, and he chose who had power to operate steamboats on any river in the state of New York. Giving Fulton this monopoly was a type of socialist experiment. How did it work out? Here is the story. Fulton and his powerful political allies franchised different steamboat routes out to different men who agreed to his terms. These men charged rates that Fulton and his allies set and gave a percentage of their profits to Fulton. No competition was allowed. The focus of our story now shifts to Governor Aaron Ogden of New Jersey, who bought the New Jersey to New York City franchise. Ogden was not thrilled with the Fulton monopoly, but Ogden saw it as the only legal way to make money transporting passengers on Fulton-approved steamboats. Aaron Ogden was happily making money when all of a sudden he was challenged by his cantankerous neighbor, Thomas Gibbons. Gibbons argued that the state of New York did not have jurisdiction over the state of New Jersey, and therefore he could operate his own steamboat legally from New Jersey to New York City. Gibbons attracted passengers immediately by charging about half as much as Ogden did for the ride from New Jersey to New York City. Now, for the first time, there was actual competition in the steamboat industry. Ogden, however, was furious. He took Gibbons to court in New York to forcibly stop him. Sure enough, the judges in the state of New York found Gibbons in violation of the Fulton monopoly. Gibbons had to withdraw his steamboat at once. Now Gibbons was furious, and he refused to do so. Gibbons was a survivor of at least two duels. He went next door to Ogden's house with a horse whip and threatened to whip Ogden. However, Ogden sneaked out the back way, found a justice of the peace, and had Gibbons arrested for trespassing. Ogden also interfered in Gibbons' family life. Gibbons' wife was interested in a divorce, and Ogden, a lawyer, gave her free advice on her divorce, and also made suggestions to Gibbons' son-in-law on how he could sue Thomas Gibbons. Gibbons was outraged, but he put down his horsewhip and made two excellent business decisions. First, he urged the U.S. Supreme Court to hear his challenge to the Fulton-Ogden monopoly. Second, he hired a young man named Cornelius Vanderbilt to be his steamboat captain and take passengers every day from New Jersey to New York and not get caught by the police, who would be waiting for him at port in New York. Vanderbilt was a classic entrepreneur, and he was intrigued by the challenge of breaking the Fulton monopoly. He sometimes avoided police by hiding in a secret compartment of his ship. Other times, he transferred his passengers when he was near New York City to another ship, which took them legally to shore in New York. At least once he dropped passengers off in shallow water, away from the police, but the passengers wanted the cheaper rates more than they valued their dry shoes and socks. On the mast of Gibbons' ship, Vanderbilt had hoisted a flag that read, "New Jersey must be free." For 60 days in 1818, Vanderbilt defied capture as he raced passengers cheaply from Elizabeth, New Jersey to New York City. He became a popular figure on the Atlantic coast as he lowered the fares and eluded the law. Finally, in 1824, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the landmark case Gibbons versus Ogden. Led by Chief Justice John Marshall, the Supreme Court sided with Gibbons. Only the federal government, not the states, could regulate interstate commerce. This extremely popular decision opened the waters of America to complete competition. A jubilant Vanderbilt was greeted in the town of New Brunswick, New Jersey, by cannon salutes, fired by, as one newspaper said, citizens desirous of testifying in a public manner their goodwill. John Marshall was also a hero of the day. Ecstatic New Yorkers immediately launched two steamboats named for John Marshall. On the Ohio River, steamboat traffic doubled in the first year after Gibbons versus Ogden, and then quadrupled after the second year. The United States not only had more steamboat traffic, it had much cheaper steamboat traffic. Fulton had charged a $7 fare for travelers on his Albany to New York City route. That would be over $150 today. A new group, the Hudson River Steamboat Association, cut the fare to $3 and put the Fulton Group out of business. With such an open environment for market entrepreneurs, Vanderbilt decided to end his pleasant association with Gibbons, buy two steamboats, and go into business for himself. To cut costs, he improved on Fulton's steamboats. Vanderbilt used the more economical tubular boilers instead of the heavy and expensive copper used by Fulton. Vanderbilt and others also saved by using anthracite coal with the new tubular boilers instead of more expensive cordwood, which had been a major cost for Fulton. Once Vanderbilt had economized, he began cheap and popular travel. During the 1830s, Vanderbilt established trade routes all over the Northeast. He offered fast and reliable service at low rates. He first tried the New York to Philadelphia route and forced the standard $3 fare down to $1. On the New Brunswick, New Jersey to New York City run, Vanderbilt charged 6 cents a trip and provided free meals. As a local journalist said, quote, "The times must be hard indeed when a traveler who wishes to save money cannot afford to walk." Moving to New York, Vanderbilt decided to compete against the Hudson River Steamboat Association, whose 10 ships probably made it the largest steamboat line in America in 1830. It tried to informally fix prices to guarantee regular profits. Vanderbilt challenged this Hudson River Steamboat Association with two boats of his own, which he called the People's Line. And Vanderbilt cut the standard New York to Albany fare from $3 to $1, then to 50 cents, and at least once to nothing. He figured it cost him $200 per day to operate his boats. If he could fill them with 100 passengers, he could take them free if they would each eat and drink $2 worth of food. Even if Vanderbilt's passengers didn't eat that much, he was putting enormous pressure on his wealthier competitors. Finally, the exasperated Steamboat Association literally bought Vanderbilt out. They gave him $100,000 plus $5,000 for 10 years if he would promise to leave the Hudson River for the next 10 years. Vanderbilt accepted, and the association raised the Albany fare back to $3. Such bribery may be wrong in theory, but it had little effect in practice. With no barriers to entry, other steamboaters came along and quickly cut the fare, just as Vanderbilt had done. They saw that it could be done for less, and they saw what happened to Vanderbilt for doing so. So almost immediately, businessman Daniel Drew began running steamboats on the Hudson, until the association paid him off too. At least five other competitors did the same thing until they too were bought off. It's hard to figure who got the better deal, those who ran steamboats and were bought out, or those who traveled on the steamboats at the new low rates. Meanwhile, Vanderbilt took his payoff money and bought bigger and faster ships to trim fares on other New England routes. He started with New York City to Hartford and slashed that fare from $5 to $1. He then knocked the New York City to Providence, Rhode Island fare in half, from $8 to $4. When he sliced it to $1, the New York Evening Post, a great newspaper of the time, called Vanderbilt, quote, "the greatest practical anti-monopolist in the country," end quote. In these rate wars, sometimes Vanderbilt's competitors bought him out. Sometimes they went broke. Sometimes they matched his rates and kept going. Some people denounced Vanderbilt for engaging in extortion, blackmail, and cutthroat competition. Of course, today he would be found in restraint of trade by the Sherman Antitrust Act. Nonetheless, Vanderbilt qualifies as a market entrepreneur. He fought monopolies, he improved steamship technology, and he cut costs. The magazine Harper's Weekly insisted that Vanderbilt's actions, quote, "must be judged by results, and the results in every case of the establishment of opposition lines by Vanderbilt has been the permanent reduction of fares." Vanderbilt himself later put it bluntly when he said, "If I could not run a steamship alongside of another man and do it as well as he could for 20% less than it cost him, I would leave the ship." That's the story of the beginnings of the man who would become the greatest steamship operator in the United States, Cornelius Vanderbilt. Well, what lessons can be learned from studying this important historical episode which launched Vanderbilt's career? I have five here that I can think of. You may be able to think of more, but let me just discuss these five. First, New York's limited experiment in socialism dismally failed. Socialism, to survive, needs complete government control over the whole economy. Fulton had this legal control in New York over steamships, but he didn't have it in New Jersey. That's an important point. Number two, incentives matter in life. We all respond to incentives. It's human nature. The Fulton monopoly, for example, had no incentive to improve in rates or in faster technology. It didn't need to. It had a monopoly. It had a guaranteed passenger group. Competition, however, gave incentives to other steamboat operators like Vanderbilt to improve his technology and lower his rates to attract more customers. That's very important for looking at the benefits of a free market economy and the problems of a socialist economy. Number three, America is an exceptional nation. Very early in our history, in the first 30 years of our history, we had an American who invented the steamboat, and we had other Americans who advanced the technology of steamboats, making them sturdier, faster, safer. You know, a lot of this is owed to the Constitution. Part of American exceptionalism is our Constitution and the wonderful benefits it provides. Article 1, Section 8, for example, limits the power of the federal government. It specified the limited things that Congress can do. However, in Article 1, Section 8, it does describe government power as being able to regulate interstate trade. Thus, the federal government was able to regulate interstate trade, which was an intervention that helped limit the government and open up competition. This is a very natural area for government to be active in. You enforce the laws of the nation, in this case, interstate trade, so that no state outside of its borders can exercise restrictions against any other state. And second, the national defense. So the proper area for government is to enforce the laws of the land, is to provide national defense, but not to give monopolies to groups on an interstate basis. Our Constitution helped America achieve its greatness. In most countries, you have to know someone to get somewhere. For example, in most countries, the way the steamboat issue would work is that somebody might invent the steamboat. He would have to get a charter by the king. He would have to receive approval by the king to keep the charter, and therefore he would have to please the king. It wouldn't matter about technology. It wouldn't matter about speed. Others would be denied access. In the United States, that isn't the way this played out because of the U.S. Constitution. Number four, we have a difference here in businessmen. And I'd like to make this distinction between political entrepreneurs and market entrepreneurs. Political entrepreneurs are those who hope to reach a profit by help from the state. Market entrepreneurs want to achieve success by lower costs of business and serving a quality product. No government is involved. The market entrepreneurs, not the political entrepreneurs, were what made America great. And notice also that the small entrepreneurs in this case were the market entrepreneurs, and they defeated the larger entrepreneurs. There was low barrier to entry in steamboats, and what we find is that even though Fulton and Ogden had political power and financial power, they could not defeat Thomas Gibbons and keep him from profitably running a steamship line. Likewise, the Hudson River Steamboat Company was large. It was powerful. It was heavily capitalized. It did not defeat Vanderbilt because Vanderbilt charged less and he made profits. Vanderbilt was a market entrepreneur. The Fulton Ogden Group were political entrepreneurs. Fifth and final, Vanderbilt became the wealthiest man in the United States, the first American to be worth $100 million. And he did it in the rest of his career the way he started his career, by offering low rates and quality service either on steamboats, steamships, or railroads. After the Civil War, Vanderbilt went into the railroad business and built the very profitable New York Central Railroad. Many thought it was the best built and best run railroad in the United States. Let me put the issue this way. When Vanderbilt, with his steamship and railroad empires, became the richest man in America, the big winner was the American consumer. Rich and poor people alike could now travel or ship products more cheaply than ever before in human history. Thus, Vanderbilt had cut the cost of almost every product Americans wanted and needed. But most historians omit that point. In the textbook, The American Pageant, which is possibly the best-selling textbook in American history, authors David Kennedy and Elizabeth Cohen are typical when they say about Vanderbilt, quote, "Though ill-educated, ungrammatical, coarse, and ruthless, he was clear-visioned. Offering superior railway service at lower rates, he amassed a fortune of $100 million. Now, if the second sentence that these textbook authors write is true, to whom was Vanderbilt ruthless? Not to consumers who received, quote, superior service at lower rates, but to his opponents, such as Robert Fulton and Aaron Ogden, who used the state to extort subsidies and impose high rates on consumers." The story of Cornelius Vanderbilt is fascinating. It is the first chapter in my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. But since this is Books with Bert, I want to recommend another book if you want to know more detailed information on Vanderbilt. That is the excellent book by T.J. Stiles, S-T-I-L-E-S, entitled The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. And that concludes today's episodes of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you get podcasts so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you liked today's episode and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and conservative ideas, be sure to check out yaf.org. Until next time, keep reading.